I'm just going to say a few words of welcome before we get underway here. Thank you all for coming out on another Tuesday night. We're 50% through with the series. We have 50% left to go. Next week will be poet Carolyn Forche, whose work I'm sure many of you know, who's a wonderful poet, who is a Michigan State graduate. And in fact, when she was here, she was in the old Dustin Morrill College, and she lived in Snyder Phillips. So of all things, here we are coming full circle again, and she's going to be back for the residential college, which is housed in Snyder Phillips. We have Gordon's books for sale tonight. One of his books, The Light People, which you can buy from the Poetry Center Programming Committee that's doing double duty as salespersons tonight in the back of the room. We also have t-shirts that say Poetry Center in the residential college that we'd be happy to sell to anybody, and a lot of information about poetry events and things that are going on. But we're really happy to have you out tonight. We hope throughout this semester and into next semester to have a lot of events associated with the Poetry Center. We have a little newsletter called the Sidewalk Press that we're publishing some information about events and some poems and things like that. You can pick up a copy of that back there. But I want to get on with our main event for tonight, which is a reading by Professor Gordon Henry. And to introduce him will be Professor Marcia Aldrich from the Department of English.
Do you not like standing behind
that? No, I don't, but you can do it. Okay. I have to pace, and it's hard to pace that.
Okay. All right. Well, we're here to listen to Gordon, not for all the introductions, but I'll say a few words. Gordon describes himself as a Native American poet and novelist, a member of the White Earth Chippewa tribe of Minnesota. His novel, The Light People, was awarded the American Book Award in 1995. His new book, which I'm really looking forward to, is comprised mostly of poems, but also includes autobiographical sketches, and is called The Failure of Certain Charms and Other Disparate Signs of Life. Have I got that right?
Yes.
Good. This book, slated to appear in the next month, is published by a British publisher called Salt Publishers. Recently, Gordon gave me some version of the book. I don't think it was the final version of the book, but a version of the book. And I was struck by any number of things. The way the prose and the poetry seemed to melt together. But perhaps more than anything, I noticed how place in Gordon's writing isn't just a destination. It's also a threshold through which to enter time and texts. It is where Gordon dwells. Where Gordon is and where Gordon comes from, in a word, place, is a defining part of who Gordon is. Gordon approaches place largely as an insider. Dwelling on his native ground is not only his motive for his life, but also his means of making sense of it. The characters and the spirits that make up White Earth are as much a part of the place as any locale, and often Gordon speaks as part of the community, as in one of my favorite poems, and I don't know if you're going to read this, but one of my favorite poems is called When Names Escaped Us. Are you going to read that?
I'm on the fence about that, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, I have it here, if you want it. I'd like to hear it,
okay,
if that would be possible.
Yeah,
I really love the poem. So I'll just leave it right here. Thank you. Let's welcome Gordon.
Am I coming through?
Yeah, I think so. Good.
Well, I want to thank Marcia for that wonderful introduction. And Sammy Gwetch to Anita Skeen in the Poetry Center. It's a really wonderful thing to have poetry coming back to life again here. It reminds me of the old graduate school days when I was here at Michigan State, and we had a pretty thriving poetry community, and it's good to see that. And I also want to thank all the faculty and students here for their support in coming out tonight. I'm going to start with prose. I kind of mix in prose and poetry with most of my work anyway, so I'll start with a prose piece. And this particular piece It comes out of a story I've been working on for years. It's been published in different parts in different journals. Published recently, I think part of it was in the Yale Medicine Review. And this is the beginning of this story of what I call seminal futures. I read a section of it last time I read here a couple of years ago. So I'll start with this. It kind of gets me into where I need to be with this. And this is a chapter from Seminal Futures. You might remember me. I'm the one who stole the eggs from the Ogumaquay frozen egg market. First, I lit cedar and wrapped a thin blanket of her blue smoke around myself, as if a woman I once loved were singing, as she held me beneath that blanket under a moon of a second night's waning. After that, I worked prayer into tobacco, smoked a little, and made an offering on that gray stone memorial outside the tribal warehouse with a historical plaque screwed on, reading, "In memory of Meskwawakesh, respected leader and troublemaker for Big Knives." Then I danced around the old warehouse a couple of times, came back in the direction I started, and I went to the warehouse door with the key Joseph Amick got from his wife's purse while she was sleeping off the glow of a Willie Nelson concert in the casino entertainment hall. I held the key up to the moonlight, then sang the song I used to sing before I got sober for the 12th time. "If you don't want me, don't dance around me. Dance, go on over there and dance. Hey, yeah, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, hey, yeah, wee, oh, hey." I put the key in, turned it a hair two ways, felt the give in the left side of the lock, and then I turned it hard left. A gaggle of geese lifted, hemming over sky blue water somewhere. The lock clicked open. I turned the doorknob, drew the flashlight with a Pedro Stitch beaded handle out from my right pocket, and I sprayed light left deep into the warehouse. I walked a ways between a few pallets of office paper, a few more of tribal museum brochures, saw the interior office right where Amick said it would be. I went there, held the light up to the door glass, and read the sign, Ogumaquay Enterprises. I fished out keys, the second stolen key. This one by Darwin Keyser from the glove box of his wife Samantha's Lincoln Continental Plus. I put the key in more forcefully this time, turned left once, and shoved the door open. I held the flashlight into the office, went to the receptionist's desk, took keys from the center desk drawer, and went to another interior door and opened that. Inside, I found hanging on the wall to the right, from the same tack that ran through a punched hole in the top center of the tribal cops of the year calendar. I took that key and got the hell out of there with the glossed eidolon of topless Sergeant December lingering in my mind, with "to protect and serve" tattooed on each breast of his bench press built chest. There was a time when there wasn't too much fighting around here. The women were bingoing like Catholics. The men were golfing like, how else can I put it, like white men on the near side of a big pension staring them in the face, or on the far side of anything resembling a midlife crisis. Then I don't know what happened. Amick said a medicine person came through and got pissed at the MC at the fall powwow, and he cursed the whole place. Keyser said it was the BIA that caused it. Arthur Bougieau said no. No, he said. We forgot to make an offering to the spirits when those construction guys cut down that first big tree at the site where the new substance abusement center is going to be. I don't know. I don't go in for theories until they happen. And most theories don't happen until whoever thought of them observes something that makes them come up with a theory. That's why you really can't trust Bougieau. He's schooled like that. He's got too many goddamn theories. He's got word theories, bird theories, work theories, theories about the sun talking. He's got theories about the pervasiveness of glass and oil-based materials and about the proliferation of images as a replacement for psychic phenomena. He's got theories about equivalencies, valencies, hotel cycles in the tourist season between the off-season and the on-season. He's got theories about Nana Bougieau, about Mudgee Kawis. He's got theories about tribal health nurses and cancer rates. He's got theories about earthquakes and orgasms and architecture. He's got theories about elevators and dream space orientations. He's got physics theories about which he claims There is no difference between come in and go in. He's got a theory for everything but the origin of theories, which he says can't have an origin because they never manifest. And because what doesn't manifest is spirit not manifested, and theories are not of a spirit. I know this because I worked many a slow night of surveillance with him at the casino hotel. So who is to say what happened between the men and women in this once beautiful land, holy land of most sacred ancestors? If you talk to the men, they'll say women got jealous. If you talk to the women, they'll say the men started spreading their seed in unnatural ways among strangers for purely economic reasons. They might be right. They might be jealous. When there's no way of knowing, I go back, take the road home to Makuntz, and I talk to the old ones there, my two uncles, the twins, Anung and Gijish Martin, together, given the right moon, a deck of cards, and a bottle of Fairbanks port. They can divine the truth, read the arrow for echoes of voices of the real stories, and the frequency of smoke they remember from every res stovepipe and chimney breath, from the number and seasonal distance of every passing vehicle on the road to tribal housing, tribal health, tribal ops, and the casino. Anung even claims they know the truth by vibration, by how quickly seeping water soaks into earth, by how long it takes wet matter to come to mud. I'm sure the truth is all that and more. But for everything I've known to be wrong, the twins have always been right. And they tell the story like this from the point of view of those whose voices they pick up on a frequency of modulation which cannot be conveyed in hiss or crackle between sundown and sunrise, and is lost sometimes on roads through Stonehill passes or beneath old railroad bridges where Angel Loves Chief still reads large and orange and concrete, to be picked up sometimes in quiet morning outside some city in the interminable exhaust of autumn. No, the twins, unlike most diviners, turn cards, drink, and set everything to page, to the flow of pen, trails of ink stains, to writing. The hand moving across the page tells all they say, and it tells all as follows. This is simple four-part instructions for making Indian lit. A bejig for the money. Take something Indian, and take something non-Indian, and make the Indian indigenous or native or skin. Make the non-Indian non-indigenous or non-native or non-skin or white. Atu for the junya. Make the Indian non-Indian and the non-Indian Indian or the white Indian. 3. Make a character out of paper. Write a name with fire or sky or a combination of color and the names of birds or the absence of an article with a present tense verb from a limited number of infinitives. You may include prepositions except these: forego, between, beyond, under, over, into, across, beside, beneath. By all means, avoid abstraction, slang, economic terms, hip phrases, or contemporary situations and signs. You cannot, for example, use the names foregoes hawk, under crow, into deer, values dog, or love crane, or dances similar. You can't use in the middle of the night red thunder banging, or a cross wolf. You can't use eating horse, bling eagle. You can't use has and trust, many shoes, sun dude, chick lid, donut shop, yard sale man, beneath the ground, upside the head, do not cross, out of position, big credit, bear pimp. You can't use stone suitcase, ice cream turtle. Can't use calls the taxi or waits for the bus, bums a smoke, or speaks the Bible. You can't use running mascara or Saint Muskrat, graffiti cloud, air flute, telescope woman, medicine cheese, karma bull, Mrs. Layups, nice one. You can't use red exit or off limits or even working man. So maybe take a break, offer prayers to the polytheistic Indo-European spirits of syntax. Inscribe a smoke or ceremony. Add laughter to fighting, tears to anything sounding like history. Reinscribe Indian non-Indian, white, repeat, smoke, smudge, rinse, repeat, imperialism, conquest, imperialism, disease, medicine, conquest, alcohol, imperialism, guns, bow, conquest, imperialism. Make language of crossing tongues as simple as powwow for profit, and a dying Chevy, hey ya, as complex as Aristotle remains ethical and remain cataloged. Use newspapers, magazine, museum brochures, scatogan, flint and match. Roll characters, names, words onto paper, paper into rolls. Rub with bear grease and lard or last night's ground beef grease. This will not work with sunflower oil or olive oil. Say four Hail Marys, a couple of ahos, a aka we can, ignite all of the above. After all this becomes lit, be careful about who you read to. They may be hearing Indian and everything non-Indian, as what remains from fire is not spirit. I wrote a couple of darker pieces here. I must have been last fall. And it really brought me back to place, as Marcia said. I really appreciate that, the thoughts on place. And these are very short, kind of what I started out writing when I used to be in Diane's class, more short lyrical poems. And so I'm going to read a few of these that I think sort of go together. And this first one's called October Minnehaha Avenue. On the red formica table, over Pontiac Keys, a cup of coffee, and a 20 for enough gas to get home. Talk is nearing enough to fire your weeping cousin's gun, as old man tobacco smoke drifts like a song and buries the intellectual shadow beyond stations of memory. When I was up Turtle Mountain a few years ago, I went to this Thirsty Dance ceremony, and during the end of the ceremony, they bring people up to this center tree for healing. And there was a guy there that they brought up. He was totally out of it, and somebody said that he's one of these sniffers. And we saw him later. He was in the cemetery sitting on a headstone. And it was part of the inspiration for this one. And it's called Huffing Inhalation. Postmodern res-edge, paint thinner, sublime. Chemical angels ride into this vacant room as walls and windows drip away into western fronts, post-depression farm boundaries barely barbed wire together, enclosed stone pile pastures, a gray horse standing still, facing north, a snort of breath drifting to a rail car passing horizon, the wind hinting the spirit of ice. Night so long, you can only hope the red blood circling for warmth in your cells don't freeze here with the rest of this lost American dream. This one's similar, really upbeat kind of poem. Res-edged suicide muse. The less dramatic seek a life of wine or some deeper downer. Brain killer inhalants for the poor, paint thinner, some non-stick aerosol maybe. Some go deeper into winter until January snow makes the road away from home impassable. Return better than the too drawn-out hope of freezing. Some seek the solace of spectators, watching the same games over and over as some follow insomnia on streets plowed toward cold, lurid dawn. In this place, pain doesn't speak. It inhabits. It ties remorse, slits skin-quick exits, ties ropes to rafters and backs down the ladder, refuses to answer phones, lets letters fill mailboxes, feeds the mood of oligarch shadows. There are more ways of doing this than all recounts of all dark nights. So hang 30, 40, 50-year-old larger-than-memory photograph on walls intended to keep others out. Talk all you want. She won't say, conversation only goes so far, dies in the hum of machinery, in the creak of a house with nothing else to do but sleep. It would be useless to try to hear what suicide says anyway. She has her own subtonal music, cast in a theater of lip sync, in dispersions of frost, in lines at a cemetery service, where wind stirs grit into faces Despair blows holes open in the earth. She imagines your song, your own voice, God speak coming out of the ground, singing something, singing, you'll always be welcome here in the earth. That's a little bleak. Let me turn instead now to a prayer. But, you know, you make it through those things. Let me turn now to a prayer that came from a story. I read, again, part of it last time, recently published in Pembroke Magazine, I believe it was last spring. I've been working on it for a while. It was inspired by a friend of mine. I'll call him Two Birds, but his real name's Two Dogs. And so Two Birds, or is it Two Dogs? Anyway, he told me one time that he has this theory about eating mushrooms, and Two Dogs will try anything. I'm not advocating that, and Two Dogs isn't either. I mean, he's very spiritual. But he has this theory. He said what he's going to do is he's going to show these spirits around when he does that. And so this story was about these two guys, these two young Indian boys that ate some kind of mushrooms. And then they go out on the road and they find this car with a saxophone in the back. Nobody's there. They take the saxophone out. They piece it together. One guy immediately picks up the saxophone and starts playing. And they start carrying the saxophone. They see the smoke from a fire and they go up this hill. And there somebody's having a sweat lodge ceremony. And so they go in. The guy leaves the saxophone outside. And it's a long story, but anyway, this is the center part of the story where the guys are inside the sweat lodge, and everybody else has prayed inside the sweat lodge, and the last speaker is one of the two characters named Goodspoken, and this is his prayer. He's the last speaker of the sweat. And he's thinking, the stone grandfathers were almost cold. The sweat ran real then. I was no longer observing. I felt spirits watching, observing me. I prayed from a small flame in a fractured indigenous heart. I prayed for the planets, the magnetic flow and binding of Elder Sun, the material world, the gaseous wraiths and shimmers, the dense matter people, the inhabitants of mists above, the being of flight, their blue wings, their morning calls from hidden limbs are brief passages through sky. I honored the keeper of vegetal villages, the makers of heal-all and pearly everlasting, the tobacco dwellers, the red willow elders, the strawberry grandmothers, the weeping sisters of squash, corn, and bean, the brothers and great uncles of syllabary shapes in oak, maple, elm, and ash. I gave thanks for the insect transformations, for the communities of bug peoples. I talked of the light-struck Mameguase. I remembered the little people, the point makers, greasy man, little Harry and Ninny. I prayed for the hunted as providers and as the wisdom behind traps and survival weapons. I saw into the center of the heart flame and watched part of it lick back into smoke. I didn't know where words came from. I remembered saying the stars' names were wrong, that the wide star roads held names of all of us and all who came before. I spoke of the dead senses of humans, of the atrophied regions of brain and vision, of the lost genes and the replication of dead moments of lust and the phoniness of our manufactured desires. I was not angry, but sorrowful. I sang the song of my dead father, recalling him barely breathing in the hospital where granddaughters sang in fours, three verses about going home. I asked for forgiveness for the anger, for the shame that leads us to worthlessness. I called on memories of diviners I'd never known. I resequenced dreams transmission, talked of vibration penetrating us as receivers and of the resonance of voices between doorways and dark nights from which we never returned. I told the stories of self-betrayal and stunned the stone hissing quiet. With tears I'd been carrying for so long, I forgot where it was I should have left them. I was drawing closer to this sorrow. I felt the spirit on my tongue walking out with my voice, ready to deliver a word of love. Anyway, Two Bears, or was it Two Birds or Two Dogs? There's a guy named Two Bears, too. But he leaves me these messages. I don't know, some people probably don't even use answering machines anymore, but I still have one. And this guy will leave me messages on my answering machine. And so I thought I'd write a poem, which isn't really about the kinds of messages he leaves, but have the spirit of his messages in them. And this one is titled, strangely enough, and I don't even really know where this title came from. If only John Ashbery were Gregory Corso. If only Gregory Corso was the terracotta horse on the coffee table with a magazine open to the You Can Be an Artist Too ad. That's the title. And I, like I said, I don't know where it came from, but it's it seemed to fit the poem in the spirit of the answering machine. Morning's another mouthful of smoke somewhere in this land of little vegetable labels. Another dog is chained to a northern laundry pole with no lines running between it and its rusting southern double, casting a T shadow. Two vowels, the Anishinaabe linguist of no standardized federal extract, has left another series of ethical questions on my answering machine, which I will not respond to until I know he will not pick up his own phone, as he will be sleeping in the skin of bear grease under a blanket of flying horses with a woman whose intelligence remains more powerful in silence than in all of his spoken words. Must the questions always be released under that same ritual of the pointing finger pulling away from the button reading messages? If someone gives me tobacco to give to someone else for a name, do they have to give me gas money to get the offering to the namer? Do we have to use the same species of trees for the ceremony this year? Can I sweat with the women of a tribe who will tell sacred stories to strangers even when there's no snow on the ground? What color cloth should I bring to the feast for the last thunder at the urban traditional's house? How many pipes should I smoke to make the sun dry the tears on my father's grave? Did you hear the one about the tribal planner and the Republican lobbyist? Is it okay to harvest strawberries in view of the cemetery? After I've burned wood, what's the proper prayer for remembering the wood as I smell the smoke on my jacket in the frozen food section of the Red Owl store? I hit a turkey on the freeway. Should I eat it or offer it to the soup kitchen people? Did you ever find that gambling medicine your aunt used the night she won on the dolphin slot machines? Do I have to smudge my Corolla after every oil change? Or do I have to have an oil change if I smudge my Corolla every 3,000 miles? We're almost done, don't worry. What kind of Indian would Jesus be if Jesus was Indian? Is that gambling medicine green and do little clusters of buds stick to your hands when you go to harvest it? Can my wife wear my grandmother's golden cross to the next ghost supper? What time should I come for the singing? Can I bring my cousin, the sniper contractor who just got back from Kandahar? After a while, all machines are like answering machines. They fill up and there's no room for anything human inside. So I pass the housed image of my glass transparent ghost self with wind antics of exterior branches. I go where I always go. After one machine is full, I get a cup of coffee and empty another. Then I pick up the phone and touch the numbers, the letters, the signs, all points of transmission. A lost voice hides in a sonic code vibration and a persistent resonant hiss waiting to crack open the night, splitting vowels, breaking infinitives of infinitives, to go line by line from a room with a terracotta horse, a sleeping dog, an ashtray of many camel butts, and a magazine open to You Can Be an Artist Too ad. To a room two vowels may never go into again. A hallway away Ohio from the dream consonant anarchy of her stuttering apnea after all. To hear what I have said instead of what I am saying, he will not be standing in the same sunstruck morning space of more questions for his rapidly filling answering machine. I'm looking for that one Marcia wanted me to read, but I'll start with a poem from, I'll read another poem from this newer work that's coming out. This is called A Profile of a Black River Member, A Thinner Narrative. State cops took his second set of keys to his SUV for the second time. He got out of some 7 codes of conduct, Redway Rehabilitation Center. Got his stomach stapled with a June per capita check. Lost 60 pounds. Left his wife and 2 boys under 5 on a blanket at the tribal fireworks. Took up with a local city councilwoman who brought him home to a bedroom full of mirrors. In November, You saw him at a ghost supper, eating only berries. He told you he was always looking for something better. November with suppers for the dead. I'm standing outside in Minnesota, ghost wind recalling names in winter mist. The road smells of dogs 2 days dead. White photographers talk in the house of mainstream media. I can't articulate the agony of Eagle Heart's children to them. We celebrate that old man while another generation shoots crushed and heated prescriptions, sells baskets, machinery, the fixtures yet to be installed in the house, yet to be heated by the tribal government. For another night, stolen by the stupors and the wondrous pleasures of forget-everything medicines. Back inside, Uncle Two Dogs rolls me a smoke out of organic American spirit. I look to a last cup of coffee. The way home fills with snow, our tracks, human and machine. When names escaped us. This is one of those poems that I really don't know what I was thinking of at the time, but I think that happens a lot, and it really worked for me at some level. It was published, I think, in a Northeast Indian Quarterly some time ago. The boy painted himself white and ran into the darkness. We let the words, he may be dead, bury him. Bury him. We took his clothes to the rummage sale in the basement of the mission. We put his photographs and drawings in a birdcage and covered it with a star quilt. For 4 nights, voices carried clear to the river. After winter, so many storms moved in. Strangers came among us. They danced. They shoveled in the shadows of trees. Then somehow we all felt, all of us, were of this one boy. A few years ago, for the fourth year in a row, someone fairly close to me died. This was in 2000. Sounds like a few years ago. It was a few people after that, too. And this is just a memory of my uncle. He was Joe Visner Jr., but we call him Sonny. Sonny's Awake, 2000. After Joe Bush prays with the Bear Poggin, after Swan and the boys from Pine Point make the vocal ascension to sing some honor song, wandering children hear this school's janitor ghost in the hallways during the Catholic liturgy. We all pass the floral presentations, the messages of regret, the army decorations, a Golden Glove fight card, the arrangement of photos, the last of a thinner man, his foot on the bumper of a red galaxy. Ahead of us, a few of the old ones, Leech Lake hymn singers, genuflect, then kneel, steady-eyed before the casket, the silver casket. They whisper so softly, the movement of our skin in our best clothes is all we hear. I read a few more, and I think I've got the end of that story of the two kids that take mushrooms. I got that I wanted to read, but every once in a while, a long time ago, I used to find myself in a phone booth trying to find my way home, and so I kind of came up with a poem that deals with that. This is called Directions to the Sovereign of Entelechy. After two rings, I hear you. A voice negotiating static modulations, hisses and whispers of futures and the latest losses, not of land, not of time, not of memory. I imagine you between lights, Bardo emotions, a few violet phosphenes under street lamps, speaking into a phone before the school ruins, before writing on eroded graffito walls with the name of every Indian who ever worked among whites. Chief. Under that, another name, Angel. Nothing changes Walls tell what can't be told in schools. Loves lost between us. Through the interference, you asking me the best way to get back home. You can see I have, when I write prose, I'm much more more worried in my poetry. It's almost I remember I read some poems in Spain, and this woman said, "Your poetry is so clear." I thought, "Wow, maybe I need to be more ambiguous and more abstract." It's too clear. And it was kind of, I wasn't sure if that was a good thing or not. Well, let me read a couple more short ones, and then I just want to finish up with one of my favorite pieces. I know you're not supposed to read what you like, but I'm going to read what I like, and you can see that we might all have different tastes. But I wrote one. I do a writing exercise once in a while when I used to work as a poet in schools, and even sometimes when I go to schools now, I work with little kids to try to write poems, whatever little kids means. And there's a poem by Joy Harjo called "She Had Some Horses" that I always use as a kind of a model for structuring poetry and for getting you out of this kind of literal mode, I guess you could say. And so it's every line begins, "She had some horses," except for the very beginning. And Joy Harjo's a saxophonist, so I decided I'd write a saxophonist meta-Americana tour for Joy H. She traveled some roads layered with paved bone dust of haiku lyres. She traveled some roads of spotted cattle remembrances, smell, and hillside grazing. She traveled some roads that ended in the closed eye of a sleeping giant behind barbed wire. She traveled some roads that opened to sleep and woke in cells breaking apart. She traveled some roads that were two roads, both less traveled, more or less. She traveled some roads beaded with blood smell of porcupine bygones. She traveled some roads that went up to doors with no knobs or handles. She traveled roads that came out in back of the theater where we shot at each other. She traveled roads that moved like celluloid through synapses of light and dark. She traveled roads with smoke and mirrors, woman, no one would know the truth by. She traveled roads with avatars of lipstick nights under a hoop of braided sweetgrass. She traveled roads by star directions and satellite positioning systems. She traveled some roads completely naked, except for earrings and jelly shoes. She traveled some roads to follow howls, to follow moon and sirens deep in the interior of passes. She traveled roads that were all ears of corporate corn and sugar beet hills. She traveled some roads behind combines of autumn, behind stone-heated Mennonite carriages of winter, behind big Winnebago summer retirement dreams, behind young thunderstorms glassed in spring. She traveled roads past giant fish restaurants with open mouth entrances, past a turtle made of wheels, past statues of upright citizens cast at the center of town. She traveled roads with no names, singing the names of alcoholic beverages and an automobile grill work and music as old as cuts and bruises. She traveled roads with bologna and cheese radicals, with trail mix anarchists, with sushi capitalists, with fasters who just finished a fast. She traveled under the influence of engine tumescence, one eye on the radiator symbol, one eye on phosphorescent road edge. She traveled roads that mushroom into Shakespeare shapes. She traveled roads of puke drafts going to yeast. She traveled roads leading nowhere to where the middle always is. She traveled some roads to lose some behind, never to find ahead. She traveled some roads exposing the hearts of still dying animals on their way to becoming road. So what happens with these two guys is they get the saxophone, they go to a party, John Coltrane's playing in the background, and then at the end of the party, they leave, and this is the end of the story. When we got back to our car, the other car, the Electra, was gone. The saxophone case flung open and empty in the middle of the road. Luke took the saxophone apart piece by piece and put all the parts back in the case except for the mouthpiece. "I'm keeping these," he said. "I'm not talking anymore. I've got my own mouthpiece to speak for me now." Then he stuck the black fixture between his lips and laughed. I tried to grab it, but he bit down hard. The fight was on then. I tackled him on the road, and we wrestled, rolling into the ditch, into rain, runoff, and mud. I punched him in the gut and heard two hisses of asshole as we rolled to the ground, and he hung biting to the mouthpiece. I felt his desperation in our fight. He fought from a deeper impulse, as if a little man inside drove him, twisted his grief to anger, his sad loss to random thrusts of a heart casting out through wild limbs. I heard him growl with the energy of loss. I got on top of Luke, pulled his head back with one hand, and yanked the sax piece from his mouth. He bit my hand. I slugged him hard in the face. I rolled away, stood, and ran parallel to the road, Luke cursing behind me, and then I threw the mouthpiece into the tall grass. I stood there then and turned, knowing Luke was coming. A thin rain began to fall. We squared off, circled each other. Luke's fist came from the hills in the dark. I took it with a movement of head, a turn of jaw, and responded with my best right cross. Luke buckled back to the road. I kicked him twice in the ribs. He groaned and drew to his knees. I kicked him twice more, once to stop him from groaning, once to start him up again. I walked over to the car, got in, turned the ignition, and called to Luke. "Get in," I said. Luke staggered over a drunken, beaten shadow. He got in. He reached into the back seat and grabbed a rolling rock. "Give me one," I said. "Last one." Then I backed the car up, pulled onto the road, and heard the crunch of the saxophone case beneath the car. I stopped the car immediately and backed up and drove forward and backed up over the case and the instrument again and again. I imagined squeezing the instrument into the earth, flattening it out sound by sound back to its mineral origins, where it would eventually become ground with everything else that would eventually die on the road. When we got back to Grandmother's standing grounds, Luke went back to his picture on the kitchen table. He picked it up, walked over to the counter, opened a drawer, and rummaged around until he drew out a scissors. He cut his father's head out of the photo, got some tape from the same drawer, and he walked into the living room. I followed. Grandmother was tied up in a chair there, her head in a knot of sleep, in front of a television set on the evangelical channel. A violet bruise pulsed on her cheekbone, and a shiny knot stretched skin into a tight bubble over her right eyebrow. Some son of a Jesus-loving son of a bitch spouted vitriol, something about prophecy, the Middle East, the Antichrist, welfare, homosexuality, and the second burning bush in the White House. I felt weary, beaten up myself. So I went to the room where Luke had gone. He had taken his father's photo head and taped it onto Jimi Hendrix's body on the poster over my bed. This somehow made things right for Luke, even in the disproportion of the merged images. I could see it in Luke's face, feel it in the lost tension about the way he carried himself. I could also feel the mushrooms wearing off. So I lay down. Luke lay down next to me. I heard him sobbing. I can feel him shivering through the sheets and the star blanket as we both lay face up staring at the ceiling. The wind blew cool through some crack in our HUD house and sang through the broken fences, the poor fit of doors, the road to the BIA school, the clinic, the Catholic cemetery, the bush-hidden trachoma cemetery of death by epidemic, the ball field chicken wire, and the Episcopal church. Then the wind sang the names of our village, Mary, then Betty, Bear's Tail, red-headed strangers. It sang right through us, ran away through res trees until it got so far away and then turned around on some dark highway to come back later to find us and lick our uncovered skin until we woke from the strangeness of our own lives. These fixed minds, these wandering bodies, stopped in spaces where we were never home. This time, under the government-made roof. I thank you all for listening. I appreciate the time. And again, thanks to Anita and Marcia. Thanks for coming out.